Welcome to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's Fiction Podcast. I'm Janet Hutchings, EQMM's editor. This month we bring you a recording made during the week of festivities surrounding the Mystery Writers of America's Edgar Allan Poe Awards, which were presented this year, as they are every year, at the end of April. One of the winners of an award at this year's Edgar's Banquet was Russell W. Johnson, who took home the Robert L. Fish Award for Best Short Story by a New American Writer for Chung Ling Su's Greatest Trick, which appeared in the January 2015 issue of EQMM. For this podcast, the North Carolina author, who is also a working lawyer, read his own twisty tale of misdirection. Here he is with his stunning debut story.
Behind every great man, there's an even greater woman, Griffin Parker says, fast-forwarding an old VHS tape of David Copperfield, searching for a certain trick. His cologne went out of style a long time ago, Jacquard maybe, and he's wearing way too much, but the scent's nostalgic and thrilling. I take a good whiff as I look around at bookshelves full of videotapes and vinyl records. Staring at me from across the room is a framed picture of some ancient-looking Chinese magician with a shaved head and long, braided ponytail draped over his shoulder. Watch any of the greats, Griffin says. Copperfield, Henning, Burton, anybody who's doing the really big tricks. Not the sleight-of-hand card trick crap I do most of the time. As Griffin says this, he cuts and reshuffles a deck of cards using only his left hand, still holding the remote in his right. What most people don't realize is that what you're looking at is just a front man. Griffin finds the spot in the tape and starts messing with the tracking, telling me how the illusion works. See, he says, it's the scantily clad female assistant who you thought was just window dressing that's making the magic happen. While the great and amazing ego waves his hands and struts and smiles and yucks it up with the audience, there's a deftly nimble but tragically unnamed woman squeezing into a hidden compartment, expertly contorting herself into a pretzel to pull off the illusion. Griffin brushes back his slick black hair to look at me with those crystal blue eyes that make it so hard to say no, and arches his eyebrows into arrow points. If you think I'm wearing something like that, you're crazy, I say. He hesitates for a beat, and I could tell he was already picturing me squeezed into one of those revealing little outfits. But he recovers quickly, playing it cool. Wear whatever you want, he says. Wear a dress, wear a pantsuit, hell, wear a burqa if you want to. The point is, once the audience gets a look at those big brown eyes, they won't be paying any attention to what I'm doing. I smile, roll my brown eyes so he knows I'm not falling for this, but I kind of am. I'm just looking for some help here, he says, rolling back the sleeves of his denim shirt. See? Nothing up these sleeves. Whatever, I say. How am I supposed to trust somebody who cons people for a living? Griffin laughs and says, I only take people for the price of admission. I haven't stolen a heart yet. I'm not stupid. I know Griffin's a player. He looks and lives like a low-level rock star, women flocking to him after shows like groupies. He spends most of the year on the road, rolling with carnivals. When he's in town, he does gigs wherever he can, including a handful of events a year at Duncan's reception hall, where I wait tables. That's where we ran into each other about 6 months ago. At first, I dismissed him as another permanent adolescent, figuring that a guy who pulls rabbits out of hats at bar mitzvahs can't be any better than all the millennial guys I've dated, living in their parents' basements, spending their nights playing video games. But now I've gotten to know Griffin. I can see that he's not immature, he's rebellious, a nonconformist, the James Dean of magic, living life on his terms, cheap and free. He calls neckties the symbolic chains of capitalism, strangling all those working stiffs who race around like rats, slaves to their own consumerism. And he's easily the best listener I've ever known. I've told him things I've never told anybody. Done my best to run him off, really. Showed him all the ugly things I'm so good at hiding. I even gave him a bullet point list explaining why I'm damaged goods and he should stay away, but none of it fazed him. Come on, Griffin says, arching his eyebrows again. Are you going to help me or not? There's no way I can do that, I say, referring to the hidden compartment he's showing me now. I'd get claustrophobic. Okay, he says, disappointed but undeterred, and runs through three more ideas, all of which would require me to prance around like a showgirl. I'm shy, I say. I don't think I could perform in front of all those people. He thinks for a minute, then says, I've got it. You can be a plant, a volunteer from the audience. Why do you need me anyway, I ask. This is a big show, he explains. A black tie event honoring some psychiatrist who's getting a big award. I need a big finale. Who, I ask. When Griffin tells me the name of the honoree, Dr. Marcus Stewart, I swallow hard. Chills rip through my body and kernels of sweat well up on my forehead. Suddenly, I feel like that scared little girl I've tried so hard to forget, hiding away in the crawl space below my grandmother's house with a flashlight and a razor, making tiny cuts on the insides of my arms. Griffin's looking at me like I'm crazy, and he's probably right. I start to explain, then stop, not sure I really want to get into this right now, but Griffin guesses. "Oh my God," he says. "That's the guy, isn't it?" Griffin hugs and holds me and kisses my head like I'm a child. That was our first kiss, I realized later, but right now I'm quivering like a wobbly grocery cart wheel. Then Griffin gets an idea and sits stark upright, clutching both my hands, asks, as serious as a slap in the face, "How would you like to expose that piece of shit for what he really is and do it on the biggest night of his life?" I'm immediately repulsed by the idea and roll my eyes. "You want me to just announce what he did to a bunch of strangers?" I say, gesturing to the mess my face has become. "No one's ever going to believe me, and he'll probably sue me for defamation." Griffin smiles wide. "What if I can get him to confess right there in the middle of the banquet?" I snort and wipe my tears. "How?" I ask, skeptical but intrigued. Griffin starts talking it through, his mind racing. "The good doctor will be called up as a volunteer for some death-defying trick. Buzzsaw, guillotine, swinging sword, something like that. He'll be in on it," Griffin says. "Or at least he'll think he is. I'll get him blindfolded. Then you come in as the second volunteer to tie him down or something. And while I'm distracting the audience, you whisper to him who you are and confront him with what he did." "What's that supposed to do?" "Let me finish," Griffin says. "I'll have you at the other end of the room, away from the crowd, so you can talk quietly without anyone ever hearing. After you confront him, you'll tell him that this time, the dangerous trick isn't a trick. The danger is real. And if he doesn't announce the truth in front of everybody, he's going to die." "You think he's going to believe that? Like we're just going to kill him if he doesn't confess?" "Not we," Griffin says. "Me." He stands up and starts pacing. "You'll tell him I've got some terminal disease, cancer maybe, and I'm a goner anyway, so I've got no problems offing him and taking the rap." "That's stupid," I say again. "He'll know it's bullshit." "It'll work," Griffin says. "I can tell you how the guillotine trick works, and you'll know for sure it's safe. But let me strap you in there with that 20-pound razor-sharp blade hanging over your throat when I say, 'Oh, geez, I can't seem to remember whether or not I flipped the safety switch,' and you're going to tell me what I want to hear." "You're crazy, Griff," I say. But Griffin assures me that the doctor is never going to be in any real danger. We'll just convince him that he is. It will just be a trick, but a trick that will get the revered Dr. Marcus Stewart to reveal to the world who he really is. "You honestly think he'll fall for it?" Griffin doesn't hesitate. He's adamant. "By the time we're done," he says, "he'll believe it." Griffin grabs my hand and squeezes. "You'll tell him I'm your boyfriend," he says. I start to give him that look that says we've been over this 100 times and you're not my boyfriend. But when I meet his eyes this time, I can't do it. Griffin's staring back at me so earnest, so intense. "You'll tell him I'm crazy in love with you," he says, "and I want to kill him for what he did." Looking into Griffin's eyes right now, I believe it. Maybe Dr. Stewart will too. Secrets are what magic is all about. Over the last few weeks, Griffin's been doing more gigs at Duncan's than usual and is becoming one of their hottest acts because people can never figure out his secrets. How does he do it? How do he know my mom's name? How did he know what dessert I was thinking of? How do he guess my favorite color? How do he cut my tie in half and put it back together? Nobody knows, not even me half the time, but I know something they don't. I'm working with him now. I'm an anonymous part of the act, a spy and deliverer of information. And that's one reason no one can know we've become a couple. I'd like to shout it from the rooftops, or at least update my relationship status on Facebook. But if they knew, Griffin says, it wouldn't be magic. I'm sitting around with my girlfriends drinking wine from a box and doing my best to dodge their questions about what has me glowing like a princess. Eventually I'll tell them, but not yet. Not until we finish with Dr. Stewart. "Just in case something goes wrong," Griffin's always reminding me. "You don't want anyone to know you had anything to do with it." I've tried my best to hide it, but I've got that warm, fuzzy feeling and can't hold back my smile. I just wink when my girlfriend asks if it's a guy that's brought on this transformation, and now they really won't let it go. They need to know who. "He's a wizard," I finally tell them. "A real magic man, and that's all I can say." My friend Sarah keeps pressing for details. I have to be careful here. Sarah used to work at Duncan's and has seen Griffin perform before. I can't let her know about us. Not now when the Psych Society dinner's just days away. Total commitment to the illusion, Griffin's always reminding me. That's what it takes. But he has agreed that I can give my girlfriends a little tease. Okay, I say, I'll prove it to you. I tell Sarah to go and fetch a deck of cards and pick any one she wants. She randomly selects the four of clubs and shows it to everyone. All right, I say, watch this. I pull out a cell phone and dial the number. Griffin and I have joked that our relationship is so deep undercover we don't even call each other, but that's easier than it sounds. My cell phone got shut off over some payment issues shortly before we started up, and Griffin is determined to be the last man on Earth without a personal tracking device. But this trick requires a phone, so I picked us up a couple of prepays the other day, paying cash for them at a 7-Eleven, and assuring Mr. Paranoid that they're completely untraceable. When there's an answer on the other line, I say, "Hello, Mr. Wizard. How are you, sweetheart? I have some friends here who've randomly selected a playing card, and I was wondering if you could magically tell them what it is." "Okay, let me put you on speakerphone so they can hear you." I hit the speaker button and hold the phone up for all to hear. Griffin says in his deepest, most disguised voice, "Four of clubs." I hang up and my friends gasp with amazement. "Do it again," Sarah insists. "Sure," I say. And she picks another card, Jack of Diamonds this time. So I make the call. "Hello, Mr. Wizard. How are you, sweetheart?" Griffin starts going through the suits. Spades, clubs. When he gets to diamonds, I interrupt him and say, "I have some friends here who have randomly selected a playing card, and I was wondering if you could magically tell them what it is." Then I listen as Griffin counts down through the cards. Ace, king, queen. As soon as he gets to Jack, I jump in and say, "Okay, let me put you on speakerphone so they can hear you." An hour later, Sarah still can't let it go. She keeps trying to guess how we do the trick, and she's convinced that it has something to do with the cell phone. Maybe I'm texting him the answer somehow. "Okay," I say, not backing down from the challenge. I offer to do it again, calling from her house phone. She pulls the three of hearts, and I call Griffin. But when he answers, he says, "Hey, baby, I thought you were busy tonight." I start to say, "Hi, Mr. Wizard," when I realize that I'm not calling him from my phone. So why is he answering the phone saying, "Hey, baby," and why does he sound surprised? I hang up. The next day I question Griffin about it, and he says he was just joking with me. I ask to see his phone, and he tells me it stopped working, so he skipped it like a stone across the Susquehanna River. Then he flashes those beautiful blue eyes at me and arches his eyebrows. I want so badly to believe him, but it's hard. The hair on my arms is standing up. I take a deep breath and remind myself that I have serious trust issues and resolve to just let it go. The shrinks start shuffling into Duncan's shortly after 6, all decked out in their tuxes and evening gowns. Griffin's working the bar area before dinner, guessing cards and pulling quarters from behind ears. I'm serving drinks and listening to conversations, scratching out notes and passing them to Griffin when nobody's looking. Later on, he's the main event and uses the intel to wow the audience with his psychic abilities. "It's all a matter of psychology," Griffin says, and the shrinks roar and clap. Soon it's time for the big finale, and this is where all of our plotting and practicing will be put to the test. My heart starts slamming into my ribs like a caged animal when Griffin says, "For this final trick, I'm going to need a volunteer from the audience." He scans the room. Before he even looks Dr. Stewart's way, the people at his table start pointing to the man of the hour. Now Stewart's up out of his seat, smiling at the round of applause he's receiving, and I'm right where I'm supposed to be, clearing away plates from the white linen table, so close I can almost touch him, and praying to God he doesn't recognize me. Not yet. "Has anyone ever heard of Chung Ling Su?" Griffin asks as he places a blindfold over Dr. Stewart's eyes, securing it tightly. Audience doesn't seem to know, so Griffin answers his own question. "Chung Ling Su was a renowned Chinese magician who toured Europe in the early 1900s, and he is the inspiration for this, the most dangerous magic trick of all time," Griffin says with a grandiose wave of his arm. "But before I tell you more, I will need another volunteer, because I want to make sure that at no point do I come into contact with Dr. Stewart, so that the audience is assured that I'm unable to pass anything to him." Hands rise into the air. Griffin is still looking at the table where Stewart had been sitting. "No, no," he says, frowning and shaking his head. "I don't want anyone who might know Dr. Stewart. Otherwise, you shrewd analysts will suspect collusion." The shrinks laugh, and Griffin scratches his chin like he's really pondering what to do. "No, no," he says. "I need somebody who doesn't know Dr. Stewart from Adam." Panning to the next table, Griffin spots the perfect candidate. "How about you, miss?" he says. And although my back is turned to him, I know he's talking about me. I'm pouring coffee for a gray-haired lady in a frumpy green dress, whose hair is pulled so tightly into a bun, I wonder if she can close her eyes. She blushes and clutches her pearl necklace. "No," I hear Griffin say. "You, miss, pouring the coffee." I keep pouring like I've got no clue he's talking about me, until everyone starts staring and pointing, and then I stop and look back. "Me?" I mouth, looking stunned. And everybody buys it as Griffin prods me along. "Do you know any of these esteemed psychiatrists?" Griffin asks. "No," I say meekly, like I'm embarrassed to breathe the same air as these well-dressed doctors and their highfalutin spouses. "Excellent," Griffin says. And now he's talking me through what to do. I walk Dr. Stewart to the far side of the room, where there's a vertical backboard set up with metal restraints. Griffin instructs me to place shackles around Dr. Stewart's wrists and ankles. "Maybe I should have brought a straitjacket for this crowd," Griffin says, and the crowd cackles. They've got 2 hours' worth of drinks in them and are really eating up the corny psychiatrist jokes now. Then Griffin jumps onto a chair and starts back into his speech, drawing all eyes to him, while I discreetly make the pass. Dr. Stewart completes it like a pro. He's practiced 50 times with Griffin over the last couple of weeks and has it down. It turned out that Dr. Stewart didn't take much convincing. Griffin just showed up at his office one day, caught Dr. Stewart in the waiting room, and asked him how he'd like to pull off a trick that would keep his friends talking about him for the rest of his life. A few minutes of pumping up the trick and vanity took hold. Stewart was hooked. All he knew about me was that there'd be another plan on the big night, but Griffin didn't want us to meet ahead of time, so it would seem more authentic. "There shouldn't be the slightest hint of familiarity between you two," Griffin had explained. Now Griffin says, "Chung Ling Su was at one time as popular as the great Houdini. So why is it that you've all heard of Houdini and none of you've ever heard of Chung Ling Su? Do you know, sir?" Griffin asks a portly man wearing a plaid bow tie. "No," he says when the man shrugs. "Well, it's because of this very trick. The one trick that was so dangerous that Houdini himself was always afraid to try it. It was a trick that Chung Ling Su became famous for until..." Griffin pauses pregnantly, then finishes his sentence as ominously as he can. "Until it killed him." A woman nearby gasps, and Griffin jumps down from his chair, waving his arms with panache. "Few magicians have dared to try it since," he says. "And of those who have, there have been 12 other documented deaths, not to mention numerous grievous injuries." Griffin has the room. All eyes are on him. That's when I lean in and whisper to Dr. Stewart. "You don't know who I am, do you?" "I'm sorry," Dr. Stewart says. "You don't know who I am, do you?" I say again. "Do I know you?" he asks. And I can already sense some uncertainty in his voice. He can hear the poison in my words. I don't think he's placed me yet. But there's something inside him that senses who, or if not who, what I am. I tell him my name, expecting him to gasp, but he doesn't make a sound. With his eyes blindfolded, I can't tell if he's scared to death or if he really doesn't remember me. So I say, "It's been almost 12 years. I was just 14 years old the last time you had sex with me in that grimy office of yours." The silver-plated .357 Magnum shines like a harvest moon when Griffin retrieves it from his magician's bag. A lady screams as the extended barrel waves menacingly about. Griffin raises a hand of calm to silence the crowd and says, "This deadliest of tricks is called the bullet catch. I've always wanted to try it, but, like Houdini, I've always felt it was just too dangerous. Unless, of course," he says with a smile, "I'm not the one being shot at." There's a smattering of nervous laughter that grows louder after Griffin says, "Tell me, Dr. Stewart, how does that make you feel?" "It's all an act," they're telling themselves. "There's no real danger, is there?" When Stewart doesn't answer, Griffin asks the security guard from the back of the room, an off-duty police officer, to come up and inspect the gun to assure the audience it's legit. "How does that bullet taste?" I ask Stewart. He doesn't answer me either, but I can tell he's swishing it around his mouth from where he tucked it in his cheek. I'd passed the bullet to Stewart moments earlier, and he'd hidden it in his mouth, waiting for the blank to fire, before he was slumped down as though he'd been hit, and then produced the bullet in his teeth, pretending to have caught it. "Does that taste like the blank, Dr. Stewart?" I say. "Oops. They really do look identical. I must have mixed it up with the real one." "What in the hell is going on?" Stewart demands. I shush him, then say, "Griffin is my boyfriend. That's what's going on. And he knows all about you. He knows everything you've done. Every depraved little detail." Stewart starts to say something, but I override him. "Shut up, Stewart. You don't have much time. You have exactly one chance to save your life." His Adam's apple is pulsing, and I can smell his fear. In just a moment, Griffin's going to ask if you have any last words. When he does, you need to yell out as loud as you can that you are a pedophile who rapes and abuses your patients. Stewart tries again to speak, but I override him once more. "And if you do," I say, "then Griffin won't shoot. But if you don't, then we are going to have a tragic accident. Griffin's got terminal cancer, so he really doesn't care what happens to him. He just wants to make sure that you get what's coming to you." Stewart starts breathing heavily, but doesn't say anything. "You've got to yell out those words in order to live," I tell him again. "Say, I am a pedophile who rapes and abuses my patients." Griffin drops a bullet into the chamber and slams it shut before continuing his story. It was on a tragic night in London, on March 23, 1918, that Chung Ling Soo performed this trick for the last time. He used a trick gun with a special channel that bypassed the barrel, but he still had to use gunpowder to create the illusion. So after every show, he would dismantle the gun to safely remove the bullet. Over time, tiny bits of gunpowder residue accumulated in the chamber, and on that fateful night, the flash from the pan ignited the charge behind the bullet, which fired and struck Chung Ling Soo in the chest. Griffin twirls the gun around his finger a few times, and everyone cringes. Then he hoists it high into the air. "Only one barrel on this gun," he says. "No tricks here, just magic." When he lowers the gun and aims it at Dr. Stewart, there are more gasps until Griffin pulls back and smiles. He turns to the audience to relay a little bit more of the story, to torture them with anticipation, and to give Dr. Stewart a little more time to think about what's coming. "In the end, however," Griffin says, "being shot on stage was not the most shocking thing that happened that night. The most shocking thing was that just before Chung Ling Soo died, he spoke. His final words were, 'Oh my God, something's happened. Lower the curtain.'" There are confused faces in the audience, so Griffin explains. "The reason this was so shocking was because when Chung Ling Soo spoke, he did so in English and with an American accent. It turns out that Chung Ling Soo's greatest trick was concealing his real identity. Soon after he died, it was discovered that Chung Ling Soo was not his real name. He wasn't even Chinese. He was actually a Caucasian American named William Ellsworth Robinson from New York City, of all places. Robinson had dramatically altered his appearance to make himself look Chinese and then stayed in character for over a decade. He completely lived his life as Chung Ling Soo, always in costume and communicating through an interpreter. When he spoke those dying words on that London stage, it was the first time he had spoken in his native tongue in 13 years. There are sounds of astonishment from the crowd, and I can hear Stewart panting like a dog. Griffin points the gun at him again now, this time gripping it with two hands to take careful aim, and says, "It's amazing how people can disguise the truth about themselves." Stewart jerks a little at that last statement, like he knows it was meant for him. "Here it comes, Stewart," I say. "Your last chance to live. You better yell it out like your life depends upon it, because it does. Say, I am a pedophile who rapes and abuses my patients." Then I back away. "Dr. Stewart, do you have any last words?" Griffin asks. At first he stays silent. The tension in the room is palpable. When the words come, they are slow and quiet, so quiet that only I can hear. First, he repeats my name, like he's finally remembering me. Then, just before the gun roars and the crowd screams, he says, as flatly as he would dictating a note, "Borderline personality disorder." Later that night, while the police are questioning Griffin, I can't help but think back to the time I played the little telephone trick on my girlfriends. Griffin is smooth, but I knew something wasn't right when he said that he'd thrown his phone in the river. I mean, who does that? Except someone who doesn't want you to go pull it out of the trash. Later that night, while Griffin was sleeping, I went snooping around a bit, and sure enough, there was his phone in the kitchen trash can, wedged inside an empty cereal box. It only took one look at the call history to figure out why he'd lied. 6 calls with Sarah over just 2 days. When there's a knock at the door, I have to suppress a smile before the detective enters. He's a big lumberjack-looking man wearing a plaid shirt. He's got lamb-chop sideburns and a big toothy smile meant to disarm me. And he's carrying 2 white foam cups full of burnt-smelling coffee. 2 questions in, and I can tell he believes it was an accident. He just has to ask me about these crazy things Griffin's saying about me being in on the trick and wanting Stewart dead. Of course I was in on the trick, I tell him. Griffin approached me about it last week after the Jolson anniversary party. What did he ask you to do exactly? I was just supposed to slip the doctor a bullet to hide in his mouth. When the gun fired a blank, the doctor was supposed to produce it like he caught it in his teeth. At least that's what Griffin told me. I've never touched that gun before in my life. He says he's your boyfriend, the detective says. Maybe in his dreams, I shoot back. I barely even know the guy. The detective leans back in his chair, stroking his chin for a minute as he considers this. So you and this Griffin fella aren't sweethearts, he says. That's what you're telling me? Absolutely not, I say. Because he says you've been dating for months. I give the detective a bewildered look that could win an Academy Award. Ask anybody, I say. I've barely ever said 2 words to the guy. The detective stares back stone-faced, so I say, if we'd been dating, there should be a ton of people who could back that up. People had seen us together. Dinner receipts, movie tickets, phone records. I promise you, you won't find any of that. Check it out, please. The detective scratches at his sideburns for nearly a minute, thinking it over. I laugh and say, if you wanted to kill somebody, why in the world would you do it in a room full of people like that? Griffin's just looking for excuses to put the blame on something other than his own incompetence. What happened is pretty obvious. He's just some small-time jackleg magician wannabe who tried a trick that was too big for him and got somebody killed. The detective starts nodding and smiling like he's thought the same thing from the start. An hour later, I'm free to go. I see Griffin being fingerprinted on my way out and blow him a little kiss when no one's looking. I know there's a chance they may find records that I was once a patient of Dr. Stewart's, but I doubt he's even kept records from that long ago. And I doubt the cops will dig that deep, because it's not what they're expecting to see. As for Griffin's wild accusations, it's just the word of a killer against mine. There's not a single witness who can back him up. No one has ever seen us together. No one can know about us. And so, no one does know. And no one will ever know. If they knew, it wouldn't be magic.
Chung Ling Soo's Greatest Trick is copyrighted by Russell W. Johnson. Music for this podcast is from Metaton and was obtained from the Community Audio section of the Internet Archive. Mixing for the podcast was done by Jackie Sherbo. You can subscribe to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, where you'll find more stories like this one, by visiting our website at www.themysteryplace.com/EQMM.